Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Edgy Ideas is proudly sponsored by the Eco Leadership Institute. We offer coach and leadership training courses, and we have a vibrant community of practice where international members join once a month for a webinar. Our focus is on co-creating the good society. To find out more, go to www.ecoleadershipinstitute.org, and to read my polemic blogs and essays, go to Simon Western at Substack. Thank you for listening. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Today we will do something different. I'm going to narrate an essay, a story I've written entitled "What Authored the Author?" I'm sharing this because it helps to reflect on the meaning of work, something I think which has been neglected. We work in organisations and organisations work in us. Our contact with the workplace is emotional, it's visceral, it's embodied. I'm going to describe my work journey with the hope that it will help you think about your own work journey and your working life. So let us begin. This essay reflects on a long, diverse and completely enriching work journey that I have travelled. However, it is more than a work biography. It is an emotional shared experience. Work is a huge part of our lives, and yet the places and experiences we have at work are rarely reflected on from the perspective of how they impact us and influence us. There are many stories we can tell of ourselves, and I have told my own story, "What Authored the Author," many times over, both in writing and in person to many diverse groups. Unlike other parts of my teaching, this story stirs something powerful in people, which at first surprised me, but now I realise that this is the point. It's not about me. This story is like a mirror. It reflects something back to the reader or the listener. What it triggers and stirs and sparks in you is important. It asks you the question, "What authored you?" Each time I tell this story to a live audience, I'm surprised as the story changes. The saying, "you can't step into a river twice," seems to be true in this case. My unconscious speaks through me and I forget something or leave something out. Or I emphasise something strongly that I don't usually pay attention to. And I may get emotional at a particular part that awakens me. This story has its own way of telling itself. And as I reread it, the story plays games with me, teaching me something new about my past life and also about my current self. I was born in a council estate in Bristol in the United Kingdom. I left school with a very poor education and a few qualifications and began work at the age of 17 as an office boy in a paper bag making factory. This was a difficult transition, from being a playful schoolboy into a very harsh work environment. In the factory, I witnessed tailors' scientific management techniques on production lines, unionised labour, clocking in and clocking out, women spending all day packing paper bags which tumbled off loud, clattering machines, men labouring to keep the machines going 24 hours a day, feeding them with heavy rolls of paper and ink. This mundane work, which is now exported to Asia, was brutalising. I remember tough men and women with a fierce humour to cope. Factory work was manual labour. The employer bought the labourer's time and body. Emotions and thinking were to be left at home. We were all cogs in the wheel of the organisational machine. This factory work has had a lasting impact on me and how I regard people at work. In my writing, consultancy, teaching, I critique human resources. We are human beings, not resources. and management techniques that instrumentalize employees to become working machines. In today's digital world, all performance is measured. We are asked to measure every service we receive, and we wear super ego technologies that tell us that we have to move, that count our every step, that monitor our sleep. I believe we have internalized the dystopian factory ideology into our workplace culture and into our bodies and our minds. Encouraged by a nursing friend who I played rugby with, I left the factory at the age of 18 and I moved on to train as a general nurse. I hadn't thought at all about this as a career, but was happy to leave the factory, and working with people seemed a good idea. This also surprised my friends. For a start with, men aren't nurses, are they? Embodied work. Nurses work intimately with the physical body, probably more than any other profession. Touching and cleaning, injecting, lifting and turning, administering drugs, dressing wounds and evacuating bowels. The nurses work with the inside of the body and with the outside of the body, with the living body and the dying body. Laying a patient out is a phrase used in nursing to dress a patient who has died. I found this process deeply moving, especially when I had closely nursed a patient. Compassionate and loving caring of a dead body seemed to me to be a continuation of the nursing care and what the patient and relatives deserved. I noticed that at some stage in the process, I could almost physically witness the soul leaving the body. I was an atheist at this time, so this experience surprised me and also comforted me. I'd lost a brother, Stephen, to leukemia when he was 7 and I was 5 years old. Perhaps my unconscious took me into nursing as a way of reparation to try and make good the loss which I had experienced and to make sense of death which had been with me since my childhood. Working with the injured, the sick and the dying made me acutely aware of the existential issues of mortality and how our emotions, thinking and identities are embodied. I worked long nursing shifts, experienced the primitive human emotions of fear and anxiety when facing mortal threats. Later, when I worked in offices and universities, I reflected on how the body is largely ignored at work. The hospital organizational and leadership context was a rigid matriarchal nursing system that had echoes of the military, a commander-in-chief, the matron, uniforms denoting rank, strict authority, no first names on the ward. The hospital organisation was structured as a social defence against facing the emotional pain of working with illness and death. Nurses weren't encouraged to talk about their feelings, and many patients were cared for physically, but not so well emotionally. After working with a traumatic death, no counselling was offered. Just an early coffee break and gallows humour in the bar after work. Space invaders. I loved the work, made great friends and learned huge amounts about life and myself, but I struggled in this constraining, institutionalised culture. Nursing leadership was predominantly female, from ward sister to hospital matron, in opposition to the medical leadership, which is predominantly male. This dual leadership created a symbolic structure replicating heteronormative parental regimes, the father leading with technical expertise and the mother being the carer. This raised my awareness of gender issues, power, responsibility, and of pay disparity. I was a male on a female team. We had 2 males in a class of 30 nurses. Often in life, I have found myself in a position of experience being othered by others. Being othered by class or by gender. And it really helped me to understand others who are marginalized through ethnicity, age, class, gender, etc. At times I was just one of the gang, accepted, and I felt a sense of belonging. Nurses are a tribal group. At other times, I was fetishized and objectified as an exotic and sought-after object. This was on the one hand. On the other hand, I was a displaced object who was out of place. As Nirmal Pawar writes, I was a space invader. I was invading the wrong space. I was treated as a lifting machine, the strong man. I was called to lift heavy patients across the hospital. I was not allowed to work on women's wards. I was once sexually harassed by a ward sister who asked me to sit on her knee when giving me a student report. When I refused, I got a negative report and I almost left the profession. Dependency cultures. Within this archetypal parental leadership model, daddy doctor and mummy nurse, the patients were symbolically childlike in their dependency. When a patient is facing major surgery or death, the contemporary rhetoric of individual choice and our desire to be in control are confronted by what Freud called the reality principle. Sometimes we have to accept our dependency on others. For some patients, the dependency culture was wholly appropriate, enabling them to give up on their autonomy to enable a surgeon's knife to be wielded and to be bed-bathed and toileted and cared for like an infant. For others, in rehabilitation, dependency culture was completely wrong and hindered their attempt to regain autonomy. Dependency cultures have place in organizations. In education, for example, learning requires us to enter a state of not knowing. If we already know something, we can't learn something new. In the hospital, this dependency culture unfortunately translated into the staff's work as well, not just the patients. It became very damaging. It undermined innovation, creativity, clear thinking, autonomous decision making. And since this time, I've been sensitive to the experience of too much dependency and a lack of autonomy in the workplace. Whilst doing general nursing, I became fascinated by the human condition. After my student training, I went travelling and returned to work in a geriatric hospital, where I was in charge of a female ward for a year, which I loved. Working with the aged was also enlightening. The humour, wisdom and resilience I witnessed was moving, and I am continually aware of the growing age apartheid in our society, where young and old rarely meet. The asylum. I left to train as a psychiatric nurse and I found the freedom more in a more relaxed and uniform-free setting, and I became totally engaged in human psychology, discovering a lifelong passion for psychotherapy and the talking cure. I worked with severely mentally ill, obsessive, neurotic, depressed, schizophrenic and psychotic patients in neighbouring mental hospital in Yorkshire. This was a Victorian-built asylum which Irving Goffman in 1961 described as a total institution. I witnessed ECT, electric convulsive therapy, and worked on wards where 70 men slept in long dorms without curtains or privacy. Behaviorist approaches such as token economy was used with the institutionalized patients. They received tokens that were exchanged for cigarettes to reinforce good behaviors, for example, getting out of bed, and they had tokens taken away for bad behaviors. Institutionalization had an impact both on staff and patients, and sometimes it was hard to tell the difference between the two. This experience of the asylum and the totalizing institution stays with me in all my work. It's created a fear within me. I am very sensitized to it. The asylum had two aspects. Firstly, it did provide asylum, i.e. a container, a safe and caring space, a refuge from the terrors of the world for those suffering severe mental trauma. And on the other hand, it was an oppressive and totalizing space. And on some wards, a dehumanizing space. When working in corporations and large public sector organizations, I'm often reminded of the asylum. I see a refined version of token economy and institutionalized culture control taking place in a more benign and hidden form. Human beings are not human resources, and yet HR teams flourish. Managers and trainers use transactional leadership, carrot and stick, to change behavior, measuring behavioral change, rewarding performance goals. And I wonder about the humanity of these methods. Transformational leaders draw on culture control to create peer and self-surveillance, where we police each other and ourselves. When I consulted to the banking system later in my career, I saw conformist employees in their dark suited uniforms sitting in rows and rows in vast open plan offices, institutionally eating in the canteen together, and I experienced a different version of a modern day asylum. I will never forget this formative experience. Humanizing organizations is one of my passions, and I ask myself, does this leadership stance enhance or diminish humanity? Other important lessons from psychiatric nursing were to discover how thin and blurred the line is between madness and sanity. And this has helped me work with some of the undiagnosed pathology that occurs in the workplace. I realise that insanity and madness are both biological and a social phenomena. At different times in history and different cultures, madness is defined differently. For example, I met a woman who had suffered from postnatal depression in the 1950s and she had never left the asylum. In psychiatric nursing, I learned counselling skills, group facilitation skills, and most importantly, how to manage my own and others' anxiety when facing dangerous and psychotic disturbance and distress. Containing anxiety has been a great transferable lesson for me. Therapeutic community. At the age of 23, I worked in a regional residential facility for emotionally disturbed adolescents. This was run as a therapeutic community with a philosophy to devolve leadership and care to the young people themselves, empowering them to take responsibility for themselves, for their therapy, and for running the regional unit. Within a year, I was promoted to become a charge nurse, often running the community. This was a huge responsibility at a young age, to be in charge of 15 to 20 people working with serious problems such as anorexia, who are suicidal, and who were abused. Working closely with the staff team, we radicalised the unit and made it fully self-catering, and the medical input was marginalised, moving the dependency culture and the stigma of being given a medical diagnosis and treated as a sick patient away. This was the most therapeutic environment I have ever experienced, and I learned two key lessons. First, my anarchic idealism that said if you remove leadership, rules and status, and then power will disappear and a pure democracy will flourish. This utopian ideal was crushed. However, I did learn that by devolving power, decision-making responsibly, creating safe boundaries and enabling leadership potential to emerge within the unit, our so-called disturbed young people were able to run the unit, made important life decisions about themselves and for others, cared for each other, and took responsibility, which was considered way beyond them. They helped us to interview and appoint new staff, to control their budget, they cooked all their meals, and they made decisions about their own destinies and supported their peers with great skill and empathy. This experimental community set in the NHS marginalised the medical model and gave power back to the client group. At this community, I learned family therapy, group therapy, and drama therapy. Single parent. In my mid-20s, I spent 3 years as a single parent on welfare. And again, I found myself challenging gender stereotypes, wandering into mother and toddler groups and struggling with the responses I received. Sometimes I was mothered, which I rejected, and other times I was considered a threat to the group norm, an external male body to be ejected. However, I loved the freedom of being a home parent, each day being thrown back to my own resources to make ends meet, and creating each day with my beautiful and delightful son, Finn. I was living in the on the margins in terms of money, and I found living without the identity and social respect that work brings to be a challenge. I was nevertheless immensely happy as a home father, making fires, telling stories, cooking. This was a time of poverty in financial terms, but wealth in terms of my time and my adventures. On returning to work, I spent 10 years training and working as a family therapist and psychotherapist with a city underclass in a deprived northern city in England. In Liverpool, I was a clinical manager of a community-based healthcare team. I loved family therapy, and I took the opportunity to be very creative in therapy sessions. In family therapy, you quickly discover that A, power is not where you think it is, B, how systems impact on individuals, and C, how patterns of communication completely entrap us, even when we really want to change. This learning has hugely influenced my leadership and coaching work since. I was in my 30s and I decided to return to education, and I studied for a master's in counselling and psychotherapy at Keele University. I felt exposed and overwhelmed and again out of place. The academic language, the rituals and culture made me feel inadequate and an imposter. I had no bachelor's degree or senior education before that. However, I adjusted over the year, and I found great joy in learning, and I excelled in my studies and gained a distinction. My thesis was written on puppets, masks, and psychotherapy, relating to my interest in how therapy has storytelling and cross-cultural roots. A few years later, I studied for another master's degree in psychoanalytic approaches to organizational consultancy and leadership. This was at the internationally renowned Tavistock Centre in London. My interest was to understand why change in the health sector was so resisted. Developing an understanding of the unconscious processes that underpin organizational culture was a huge learning experience for me, which I have applied in my work ever since. I finally left the NHS feeling burnt out from the pressures of working with disturbed families, suicidal teenagers in an under-resourced provision. I was frustrated by a leadership dominated by medical power, which allowed little room for constructive dissent and change, particularly if it came from a nurse. The medical model provided the wrong leadership, the wrong culture, the wrong treatment for these young people and their families. For the most part, my clients were not ill, but suffered from emotional and social strains of living in a post-industrial society undermined by poverty, drugs, crime and unemployment. They require therapeutic and emotional support, more resources and structural and political change rather than a medical diagnosis, labels and medicine. My attempts with talented and committed others to make changes were partly successful, and more collaborative work now takes place. However, the NHS has an institutional leadership culture that allows little room for innovation or creativity, and it was time for me to break out. Quakers and faith. Another experience which has informed my understanding of leadership and organizational culture is my religious affiliation. I've been a Quaker, the religious society of Friends, since my mid-30s. And this contrasted with the secular society all around me. Quakers have an unusual organizational structure without formal leadership. They do not appoint church ministers, but believe in a priesthood of all believers. This abolishes not the priests, but it abolishes the laity. We are all priests. The business meetings are run and have been for 350 years by spiritual consensus. Local, regional and national meetings decide on Quaker policy. Quakers don't vote, but they wait in silence until spiritual consensus is agreed, which means individuals often have to balance their personal convictions with the collective will. Quaker meetings are structured around the idea of equality, sitting in a circle, in silence. anyone moved to speak can minister to those present. The Quaker history was an important part of my PhD research, leading me to examine how their informal leadership and organization have changed over the centuries to accommodate social change while still holding on to the essential experience and structures. More recently, I joined the Church of Ireland and I have dual membership of the Quaker and Anglican communities, appreciating both traditions and their different leadership and organizational structures. My experience in leadership has also been informed by engaging with social movements and friends who are activists in trade unions, feminist, anarchist, and green movements. This informed some research on autonomous leadership, which I published, and much of my thinking on eco-leadership. I work with the idea that the human spirit is important in leadership and in organizations, whether you have a faith or not. More recently, I've been invited to work with the Church of England leaders and to visit Rome to support leadership program across the Catholic Church. This is to support the development of Pope Francis' initiative of a synodal church, a church that changes from the bottom up and engages with the marginalized, the indigenous, and to allow women to have a greater role in leading the church. Frustrated by being a nurse and a clinical manager in the NHS and a little burnt out, I decided to seek new pastures and I entered academia. I went to Lancaster University to study for a PhD in leadership and I quickly found full-time employment working in leadership development and executive education. Academia is underpinned by a dependency culture that replicates the educational models of teacher-student dynamics, and it tends towards bureaucratic managerialism. These days, the university also embraces a culture of capitalism and is financially driven to the dismay of many of the faculty. I worked in the exec leadership field and suddenly found myself working with very senior corporate leaders internationally, designing and offering coaching and experiential learning. From working with the most poor and marginalized in Liverpool, I found myself flying to San Francisco and working with senior executives in large corporations. It was quite a shock. My saving grace was the capacity that I had developed to think in the face of anxiety, drawing on my past experience, which enabled me to coach and work in depth with these powerful executives. I was later appointed Director of Coaching at Lancaster University, where I established a critical approach to coaching, drawing heavily on psychoanalytic and systems thinking. After 10 years of executive education, I left to work as an organizational consultant and to direct a master's degree in organizational consultancy at the Tavistock Clinic, where I was previously a student. And I later chose to work independently, setting up a new coaching and consulting company specializing in eco-leadership. I founded the Eco-Leadership Institute more recently and put into practice my theoretical work on developing ideas around new leadership for new times. We run coaching and leadership courses. We have a dynamic community of practice learning together, and we are a think tank continually developing and publishing ideas to support organizational change that can adapt to the climate crisis and to technological and social disruptions in our precarious and our interdependent world. Being an entrepreneur is interesting. The shift from being a sole trader to a startup company and thinking about marketing and branding and building a team is fascinating and creative. My work continues to draw on the past experience I have shared and integrate these into the way I think and the way I deliver leadership development. I remain intrigued by psychoanalysis and the unconscious at work, and in 2017 was elected as president of ISPSO, an international society working with the psychoanalytic study of organizations. My latest venture has been for the Eco-Leadership Institute to partner with the Humanitarian Leadership Academy and with Save the Children to deliver a radical change in the humanitarian sector we're calling eco-mutualism. This work takes me full circle in many ways, bringing a life's work with people back to the fundamentals of how to create a more humane and compassionate world. My journey highlights the movement from working with the body in the factory and as a nurse to working with the mind as a psychiatric nurse and therapist, from working with the individual and the small group as a family therapist, and then with organizational systems as an organizational consultant, and finally with the wider social issues by engaging with academia and psychosocial studies of politics and taking philosophical positions. Leadership crosses all of these dimensions: the body, the mind, the individual, the team, the organization, and the social and the political. And my work emanates from the culmination of this lived experience. I hope this reading has set you thinking and helps you to reflect on your own career and life journey. Thank you for listening.